Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Our goal is to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. I want to thank you for joining us with Central Coast Voices today. We try and address, and hopefully we address them for you most of the time, how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. This is probably a more appropriate way to introduce the program than it is on most cases, because today we're going to talk about climate change and local action plans for climate change and planning for a basically low-carbon community locally as best we can. My guests today are Michael Boswell, who's a professor of city and regional planning at Cal Poly, and Tammy Seal, who's the director of sustainability and climate change services at Michael Baker International. And yes, we'll clarify in a moment what Michael Baker International is, because unlike saying someone's from Cal Poly, it's probably hard to discern as to where that connection is and how it comes together with this. I want to remind you that Action for Healthy Communities is the sponsor of this program, and we do a report every 3 years called Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County. That last report was done on the three-year cycle in December of 13, and the current study is underway right now, and you may get a phone call or a contact to be part of that survey between now and about the end of May. If you get a chance to participate, please do so. You can see full reports from past years at actionslo.org. That's www.actionslo.org. It's an extensive report. It's available for download at no charge. You can look at it online or download the all or part of the rather copious quantity of PDF files that are part of that, but it's fascinating information about our community. This is a call-in program. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. I want to encourage you to be part of this discussion. We appreciate it when you like what our guests have to say, and we appreciate that also, but we especially appreciate it when you want to be part of the discussion to give us some idea of how it does or doesn't affect you. Everyone agrees that, that climate change is affecting us today. And today we're going to talk about basically what actions can be taken at a local level, regionally, public health-wise, in the local community. So we're dealing today with Michael Boswell, who is a professor of city and regional planning at Cal Poly, Tammy Seal, who is the director of sustainability and climate change services for Michael Baker International. And I guess where we're going to start, and I warned Tammy about this, is you probably need to tell us what Michael Baker has to do with sustainability of communities and climate change, because that's probably what people will scratch their head about if we don't answer it reasonably early in the program.
Sure. Okay. So I am a planner by training, and that's the service that I provide. So I'm a city and regional or environmental planner. Michael Baker International is an international firm providing services to clients to achieve their sustainability and resiliency goals, whether that's in infrastructure, community planning, bridge building, you name it, we do it.
Okay.
And so we're a large firm, and now on the Central Coast, we provide our sustainability and climate change and community planning services to cities.
Yeah, I'm glad we got that out of the way, and I'm sorry that I made you go through that. But, I mean, if someone were to say that you worked for BP, everybody would know that British Petroleum is in the petroleum industry. Someone with an organization with a name like Michael Baker International, it's kind of hard to define, so I appreciate you for defining that. Well, having said that, let me shift to you, Michael. What is it about regional planning that has moved us into using that as a way to look at what's happening with climate change?
That's a great question. So as probably most people know, particularly this year, there's been quite a bit of international action on raising awareness about the issue of climate change and trying to find solutions to the issues of climate change. We just had the Paris conference in December, which I'd be happy to talk about at some point today if you want to talk about that. But really, prior to the Paris conference, we had seen a number of somewhat successful but also somewhat failed attempts to bring the international community together to address the issue. It is a global problem, and we sort of – I always say we need all hands on deck to solve the problem. But we had seen a sort of lack of a very clear action at the international level and even at the national level in the United States. And so what we began to see about a decade ago were cities and counties and regions really began to step up to address the issue of climate change, saying, you know, if our national and international organizations aren't going to do this, we're going to do it. A number of cities in the United States, for example, Chicago was a quite notable one, really made a big effort in this area. For those of us who are in city and regional planning, who had been working on all sorts of local issues for, you know, our careers, to us this was also a natural fit. So not only were, you know, big cities and mayors sort of seeing they needed to step up to fill this role, but those of us who had been sort of working in the trenches said, well, this is, we know how to do this. This fits with the way we're thinking. I always like to say that, you know, climate planning is just good city planning. Many of the things that we've wanted to do in cities for many years that are good for a whole variety of other reasons to do are also great for addressing the climate change issue. So take transportation, for example. Planners have been working for a long time to try to enhance our transit systems, our bike and ped systems, you know, getting people onto those modes of transportation. There's lots of good reasons to do that, but one of them also happens to be that it will be good for addressing the climate change issue.
I would think that at the local level, we're able to become less partisan about it. I'm surprised at how drastically partisan the issue of climate change has been on a national level, and to some extent on an international level, but more of a U.S. national level. But I think locally, there may be people, if you're a Republican, you may have friends that are Democrats and you still mm-hmm. believe they're your friends. Mm-hmm. On the national level, that seems to be less of the case. So I would assume that less finger pointing and more desire to actually solve the problem is happening on the local level.
Yes, I think that's true. You know, things are much more tangible at the local level. And, you know, we talk about the idea of co-benefits, which is just simply the idea that, you know, many of the things that we need and ought to be doing to address the issue of climate change are things that are great for the community anyway. So, you know, whether it's talking about something like energy efficiency and the need to ensure that our houses and businesses are more energy efficient, that's good for the climate, but that's also good for your pocketbook.
Yeah,
you're going to be saving money. Yeah. I think that practical action when put in those sorts of terms is much easier to handle at the local level.
Understood. Yeah, we have a call already. And Scott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. What do you want to bring into the conversation?
Well, I was an energy upgrade specialist for San Luis Obispo County, and I want to bring up community choice aggregation.
Okay. Go ahead.
So community choice aggregation is a law that was passed in 2002, which enables communities to bundle their energy purchasing power. Essentially, they create an energy district and are able to purchase renewable sources and reinvest the profits from the energy purchase back into the community for local renewable build-out. We've seen this happen in Marin and Sonoma. And in Sonoma in particular, which is very similar to our county and our community, residents are paying less for their energy, and they're getting 50% renewable for a lesser price.
Okay.
So it's been a very effective tool for reducing carbon emissions and reinvesting into local renewable build-out.
Okay, so for a layman on my side of this, let me throw this in here. This is kind of like something we may have done 100 years ago, which is if there were five of us that had properties in a reasonable rural area, we might have a common well that we share. Is that a similar type of picture?
I think for the layman, a similar picture is, you know, for instance, Costco. You have got a number of people paying into a program. Let's see, or how about Farm Supply? This is a local co-op.
Okay.
So it's a local co-op. They are able to bulk purchase energy for the people that shop at this co-op, or bulk purchase products, and people are able to realize a saving through bulk purchasing. The law, what it allows is for our supervisors, the county board, and our communities, through a majority vote, to adopt this system, and everyone is automatically put into the community purchasing power. So it makes it feasible.
Okay.
And so what it does is it allows bundle purchasing. It's a nonprofit. The savings go back into the county or the cities that are running the program.
Okay. I don't want to cut you off, but as I'm listening to this, my thought is I'll get some feedback from our guests. This probably sounds like it's a topic that will indeed be very good on a future program for an entire program. And so I think at that point, I'm going to let my guests comment about it. Can you listen on the radio?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay,
and then,
great.
Also important to note is San Luis Obispo County is participating in a feasibility study with Santa Barbara and Ventura counties to create a local community choice program. So it's on our county's agenda right now. And I think September of this year, we should be getting that feasibility study back.
Okay. I'm going to put you on hold because I'd like our producer to get a contact information from you. So hold on a second, okay? And thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All righty. That's a fascinating topic. I think we just set that for another program. A couple of you look like this is a person that you know and know what the work is they do. Can we get a synopsis of what this looks like as a possibility for our community and maybe what its benefit is with regard to climate change from either of you?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about how it's been used in other communities. What's important to note about community choice aggregation, and sometimes it's called community choice energy, is that it provides local control over the purchase of procurement of energy. You still partner with your utility to distribute the energy. Customer service is not interrupted. You still get your energy at your house or your business just like you would if you got it from PG&E. Mm-hmm. What the priority of CCAs is that they allow the organizations running them, which are usually local governments, to determine the mix of energy. And local governments who form CCAs are usually looking to have a portfolio, which is what your energy mix is called, that has a high percentage of renewable energy sources in it. And that's what provides the greenhouse gas reduction benefit, which considers it to be a benefit to the climate. And in Marin and Sonoma County, they've had the options of offering their consumers the option to get, let's say, 50% renewable or 100%. All the energy to your home is from a renewable energy source. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's appealing about this. And it provides direct local control. And in addition to Marin and Sonoma counties, we've seen the city of Lancaster just launch their program last fall. And we've seen other cities in the Bay Area join the Marin County CCA.
Can it be done as a small cooperative of non-government agencies? In other words, if I happen to live on a block in Atascadero where most of the residences are in about 2-acre parcels, I happen to have the parcel that has the most clear path to sunlight of most of my neighbors. They all have more trees than I do. Doggone them. Anyway, so we might get together and decide that I've got an acre and a half of usable space for us to put up a small solar farm that we might share among 8 or 10 residences. Does it work for things like that, or does it only work for municipalities and government agencies doing it?
The example you're providing, you can do without a CCA.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Just a small-scale community solar. You can go ahead and do that. The system allows you to do that. The CCAs are usually formed by either counties and groups of cities because it is better to have a larger group. And as noted, there's a number of feasibility studies going on right now, and that's where you're going to find the right mix, like how many cities or how many counties should come together to leverage their power.
I think we'll have another program about this.
It's a great
yeah.
topic.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Michael. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple things, too, is, you know, there's an issue of where the energy is coming from. So usually when the CCAs are starting, they are purchasing power from large scale energy providers, again, usually aiming for a very high mix or completely renewable, as opposed to the example you were giving, which is, would be sort of, you know, producing it locally. Yeah. Although what we have seen is that most CCAs, as they start to grow and develop, is that they will even take some of the investment and begin to develop their own solar energy as well. So the CCA is actually, solar's example, producing some of their own energy. And I also want to note we had, in talking, Tammy mentioned Lancaster. Last summer we had a California Climate Action Planning Conference at Cal Poly, and the city manager came from Lancaster and spoke there. And the thing I took away from his talk is he said, you know, if you're a city and a county, if there's anything you're doing to address climate change and clean energy, this is what you ought to be doing. Very strong advocate of it. And I think Lancaster has shown a very innovative approach. So they're a very good example for folks out there interested in learning more about CCA. I would suggest looking at what the city of Lancaster is doing. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And you know, Tammy, what you said leads me, and then what Michael followed up on, it leads me to believe that even if we were looking at a situation where the best supplier of the most renewable energy wasn't PG&E, let's say, but we wanted to set the system up, then you set the system up and you start getting power from the most definable source that can provide you what you need now. And once you've set that network up, then you can look at alternative ways to drop in other power sources. PG&E may not appreciate that, but that may be a way to – you've got to start somewhere. And sometimes if you can start with the knowable, usable entity and then move from there, I don't know if that's a possibility or not.
Yeah, I think it's fair to note that the overall state mix of energy in California is cleaner than most states. And we have what's called the Renewables Portfolio Standard in California that requires our utilities to at least – acquire 33% of their portfolios from renewable sources, and that's increasing to 50% by 2030. So we do have clean energy in California that's on our side. And the CCAs offer the opportunity to go further, to have more direct control over where that's coming from, whether it's a neighboring county or within the state of California, and then to give that money directly back to the community when there are profits. They go back to energy efficiency improvements and to creating more renewable energy opportunities.
Terrific. Sorry. See, we've got a caller. I'm sorry I kept them. Jeremy, are you there?
I am.
Sorry to keep you waiting for so long. It's a complex topic. What do you want to add to the discussion today?
I was calling to comment on what I heard in relation to public transit. I'm a dedicated bus rider between my home in Cayucas and work in Cambria. I have seen ridership decline, mainly due to services being cut back. So I'm curious what's being done to increase ridership in RTA. The last run heading south leaves at 4 o'clock, which makes it difficult for the average working person to get that bus home. I'm fortunate to have some flexibility in my schedule, but it doesn't seem to me like it's being promoted. It seems to me like it's being taken away. And I'm also curious if there's any sort of tax incentive for public transportation. In filing my taxes this year, I was looking for some way that I could write off the $44 a month I spend on public transportation, but I wasn't aware of anything. So that would be a suggestion as well, is that if we can somehow, you know, make it a tax incentive. But I am curious as to what's being done to promote it when it seems to be being taken away from us.
Okay. Michael, jump in. Yeah, hold on, and thank you. That's a very good question, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Yes, good question. I'm a regular bus rider as well. I took the bus to work this morning, although that was on slow transit, not the RTA system. So I'm a little more familiar with slow than the regional system, but this is an ongoing challenge in many communities, is identifying funding for transit. You know, unfortunately, we still continue to be a nation and to some extent a state that prioritizes automobile transportation over all other modes of transportation for funding. Much of our funding, particularly for things like transit, is ultimately coming from federal transportation dollars. And I'm going to assume we won't venture into the federal politics discussion today, but I'm sure you're aware of how challenging that situation is. And so so that's sort of where we are. Most transit agencies are struggling to balance the issue of adequate service provision with the funding that they've been given. I think in California, we've got a few things that are going for us that will begin to pay off in hopefully the near future in terms of really enhancing where we are in transit. And before I identify those, it's also, you know, it's important to keep in mind that ultimately these are, you know, the RTA and slow transit that we have here, these are decisions that are being made locally by our local decision makers, and we see the deployment and effectiveness of transit vary quite a bit throughout the state. If you go down to Los Angeles, for example, what you would find is an immense investment that's been made over the last decade in expanding the metro system. Next month, the metro line will go to Santa Monica. It'll be the first time we've had rail to Santa Monica since I think the 40s or something like that. But there's two bright points I would point out. One is California now has a cap and trade program, which is something else we could talk about too if we want to. But basically, large emitters of greenhouse gas emissions in California are now having to essentially pay a fee to be able to continue to do that. And a portion of that money will be coming back to, or will be taken by the state and invested both in statewide transportation and transit systems, and there'll be ultimately some money for local governments. So that's a good program, but we're just in the early days there. The other is there's a Senate bill that was passed a number of years ago called SB 375, or the Sustainable Communities Strategy, and that's requiring our regional transportation agencies to look at transportation from a regional perspective. So for us, that's – well, in this county, that's Slo County, basically. Look at a regional look at it from a regional perspective and identify how they are going to make investments in transportation that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And for a place like Slo County, that's going to have to ultimately be a significant investment in transit. Because we're at a dispersed county with quite a bit of commuting between the cities, transit's going to be our solution there. So I think both of those are relatively new, though. I think in San Luis Obispo, we just finished our SCS last year, I believe. So we've only had it in place for a very short time. So hopefully the future looks brighter. But as a fellow bus rider, I also pretty regularly wish the wait times were a little less and there were some additional routes I could use.
Yeah. Jeremy, there's another aspect of this that part of what I do besides hosting a radio program, which is a volunteer effort, by the way, is I do some ridership enhancement work for transportation. I used to do some of this work for the city of San Luis Obispo. One of the things that we've seen happen is that as the gas tax has gone down, the amount of money from gas tax – the gas tax has gone down because it's a percentage at the federal level and gas prices have gone down again. A good portion of that gas tax is used – diverted for transportation and transit issues, and that pot of money has gone down at the federal level. And the actual cost of public transportation – in our county and in most places comes from about 75% to 80% of it being federal dollars paying for the undercarriage of the system, if you will, and then your actual fare not only covering about 20% more. There is an effort in San Luis County, and it's just started at the SLOCOG, the Council of Governments level, to put a ballot initiative together to raise the sales tax countywide by one half of 1%. And that would all be transportation and transit uses for that money when it's in a pot. You'll hear more about that over the next 6 months because it's an issue that's just unfolding. The Council of Governments Board just sent their proposal on how to proceed with this to all the cities, and the cities are looking at it now. But there's an understanding at the regional level of SLOCOG that there's not enough money and it's needed, and it's a way to address it. This probably didn't address – this doesn't fix your problem, but I think it at least gives you some idea of that it's not being ignored by others.
It does that. It does. I'm not as delusioned as I was before, so.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks
for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay.
I want to remind you, this is Central Coast Voices, and we're having what I'm appreciating as a very intense discussion about climate change and sustainability and how it affects our local community as opposed to looking at it as a national issue. This is Public Radio KCBX, and we're glad you're part of the discussion today. We want to remind you that it is a call-in program. You're welcome to join the discussion at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Jeremy brought up an issue that I think probably comes up very often, and that is none of this stuff comes for free, and who's going to pay for it in what amounts to a dwindling pot of money. How do we address that question first?
Well, what we talk about when we are looking at putting together climate action plans for communities is one of the important considerations is to identify the cost of programs. Some things have little or no cost, and some things are going to have significant cost. And every community is going to have to sort of think through what are their priorities, what are their funding sources in order to be able to make these types of decisions. Funding gets complicated, right? Because there, on the one hand, there you might identify something good you want to do in your community. Let's say you want to put solar panels on City Hall, right? And, you know, local government immediately has to begin to ask itself a few questions. One, could we fund this locally? You know, do we have in our general fund budget or our capital fund, capital programs budget, the money to do this ourselves? If so, maybe that's the easy answer. You do it yourself internally, and presumably, you know, a solar panel on the rooftop is going to have a relatively quick payoff. Mm-hmm. And so that's a temporary cost, but it is still an upfront cost you have to pay. If those resources aren't available, there's the possibility of going to the state. There are a whole host of state grant programs. There are programs that are run through the utilities as well to support energy efficiency types of programs. And then possibly even through federal grant dollars, for example. So matching up those, there are dollars out there, and matching those up can be quite valuable. The other thing is to look for opportunities that maybe don't cost a lot of money or that leverage local partnerships. I've been active since the beginning with the Bike Slow County, used to be called the San Luis Obispo County Bicycle Coalition. And, you know, they're a nonprofit organization. They're an important part of this community in terms of educating about cycling, advocating for cycling issues, and facilitating creating better communities for biking and walking. And, you know, they've been a great partner with the city of San Luis Obispo, with cities throughout the county, really, and the county, in assisting those communities in meeting their goals for increasing the number of people who ride their bikes, commute by bike. And, you know, those are low or free services because those are nonprofit organizations. And so those kind of partnerships can be very valuable in achieving certain objectives as well. For things that cost a lot of money and it's not clear where the money is going to come from, these require, you know, cities and counties to make strong, clear commitments, and requires strong political leadership to do that. Some cities have been pretty clever about these kinds of things as well. I want to say it's the city of Phoenix, but I may be misremembering, but they developed a fund in the city a number of years ago that they initially put some money into, And it was to do energy upgrades throughout all city facilities, libraries, wastewater treatment plants, schools, you name it. And what they would do is they would make these initial upfront investments, and then the cost savings over their baseline, they would take those cost savings and reinvest them back into the fund to kind of keep the fund running. So it had essentially an initial real cost to it, but now it's kind of running itself through the savings that the city is realizing through energy. So it's a very clever approach. Some cities in the U.S. have created a carbon tax, particularly if they have some ability to control their own energy supply. So Boulder, Colorado, is one of the more notable ones there, where they worked with the local energy provider. It's a very small additional tax on top of the energy bill that goes and pays for climate-related programs, environmental programs, I think, generally, but climate-specific. Yeah.
Are we in a county, from my perspective, but it may be the people I hang out with, we have a county that's not – climate denial is not a major factor in this county with the people I hang out with. Now, I may be in the wrong group of people. I don't know. Are you finding much resistance? I mean, Tammy, you deal with municipalities. Are they feeling like, and are you hearing city councils that are implying that that we're once again asking government to find a new way to waste money?
I think that climate change and climate action planning, like most topics in front of city councils and boards of supervisors, can be subject to partisan politics. Okay. We do find that there are skeptics who are engaged in our process. There are also people who are very much very passionate and committed to addressing climate change. For when I'm working with cities and counties, what we're really looking to do is identify the best practices and what they're already doing and how to turn those or maybe extend those processes to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or leverage the co-benefits. As Mike said earlier, you know, good city planning is often the same as good climate action planning. And doing things to upgrade your public infrastructure, to install bike lanes, to widen your sidewalks, to allow people to move around more easily by foot, to conserve water, to increase efficiency of your energy and water. These are all good practices in running your community. They save the community money, they save the individual money, and they also will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and help you adapt to a changing climate. So we have to help broaden the conversation, because it's not – climate change isn't a narrow topic, and what we do is help people make relationships and connections.
Yeah. There's a national program that's administered locally through Rideshare called Safe Routes to School. Mm-hmm. As I've read some things about that and been involved in part of that process – the average person looking at that looks at it from a standpoint of a safer route to school makes it safer for my child, and that's all I care about. And that's the first thing they should care about. So I'm not implying that's not a good idea. When you talk to those same parents about that and say a simple thing like, well, that's great. If your child can walk to school every day and you're less worried about them doing that, then you're going to get in your car and drive them the mile or two to school 20 times less often than you did last month. I'm surprised at the number of parents that they haven't occurred to them that there was an unanticipated positive consequence of what a safe route to school is. And after talking about that with some people, my feeling was that was never what safe routes to school was meant to be, but it becomes a collateral improvement, if you will. How many other projects, like getting people out of their cars and riding their bicycles if there's more bike paths, are being quantified for what they actually will do for the for decreasing the carbon footprint?
Well, a big part of the work that I do with my team is quantifying what all of these actions mean. So when you add a mile of bike lane, there's a quantifiable GHG reduction that comes with that. So we can determine how many more people will ride their bike by the addition of bike lanes, and how many people then are out of their cars, and what that translates to in a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. So there's very much an accounting that goes on in this climate action planning process, and I have a team of people, and we quantify everything that an individual or a government could do to reduce their carbon footprint. So that's what we do to show our work and to demonstrate that these are real and effective programs. We also recognize there are co-benefits that can't be quantified. Just as a personal example, and you know, I've been committed to being an environmental planner and a bike advocate my whole life. But probably one of the things, the bad habits I got into was driving to work, which it's hard to admit over the air that I actually used to drive to work. And the sad part is I lived a mile and a half from work. And a year ago, my office relocated, the distance shortened, and I started walking to work every day. Mm-hmm. And it's the best decision I've ever made. My back pain is gone. I'm happier. I can appreciate and be part of my community, and I feel much more engaged in where I live and who I am. And I can't quantify that, but I can tell you that I'm happier, and that's part of living in San Luis Obispo, is appreciating the high quality of life that we have and the easy access we have to it, that making a decision to stop driving isn't that hard to do here.
I would suggest to you that you can't quantify it, but there may be other people on the road that can quantify it, because they're now seeing one less car in front of them or behind them or next to them in the morning. If they still have to drive, you're not there. And I don't mean that as a flip comment. I mean, I think that becomes a factor. I think we lose track of what distance we're comfortable walking or not walking. If a few years ago, if you had told me that walking almost 3 miles a day was something I would do on a regular basis, I would tell you were crazy. I would think that would be way too big a waste of my time, if you will, and not enough real viable exercise. I now walk about 2.8 miles at least 5 days a week. And I would have 5 or 6 years ago said that's not a reasonable thing to do. Unfortunately, that distance is not a distance I can walk to a place of work, but it's easy for me in most cases. My office for most of my business activities is in my house, so I have to walk down the hall. But I think for a lot of us in this county, it may work very well for the city of San Luis Obispo, may work very well if you happen to live in downtown Paso Robles, but it's not a terribly walkable community as a county-wide issue. I think that's something that we probably need to look at. I realize we've kept Bill on hold for a while here, and so Bill and Arroyo Grande, sorry to have you on hold for so long. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Jump on in.
Okay, yeah, when you were talking about funding for mass transit, I had an idea. One of my ex-wives was telling me the other day that when she bought her Volkswagen diesel a couple of years ago, she did it because she thought she was buying a fuel-efficient car. And now they're talking about recalling all these cars and mushing them up. And my idea was, instead of, you know, shredding all these illegal cars, they ought to let people own their cars and take the money that they would do that with and give it to mass transit authorities.
It's a good point. By the way,
you might run that by, you know, a bunch of Volkswagen owners and see what they think about it, but, you know.
Actually, I have a Volkswagen owner in my family, and we've followed it. I believe Volkswagen, within the last couple of days, has come up with a plan that hasn't been approved by the government agencies and courts that are involved in this process. But it's going to give people the ability to either sell their car back to Volkswagen or at Volkswagen's expense have it retrofitted for the way it should have been. How that'll actually pan out, I don't know. But I would agree. I'd rather see something like that done than shred or just tear up anything that didn't work before.
Yeah. I mean, they're good cars. I mean, they're polluting, but, you know, they're still running.
Yeah. If you were to talk to my adult daughter in San Jose, she would tell you that she screamed at Volkswagen the minute she heard about this, because they indeed bought a diesel Volkswagen because they felt it was a contribution to a more sustainable community, and they feel burned by that now.
Yeah, that's the way she feels too.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay.
Thanks for the call, Bill.
Sure, bye.
We talked a little bit about it, and this may not be this may be a part of this topic that we that doesn't get us what we want, but it's something that's on the top of my mind. 3 years ago, about 3 years ago now, when we installed solar on our house, we were one of the first people we knew to install solar in Atascadero. Now, yeah, there's companies that install solar in Atascadero. There were plenty of things going on. But it's taken off drastically. I look at a community that tends to be a little more conservative and a little less environmentally conscious than a lot of other parts of the county. And the difference between 3 years ago and now is the difference between 10 or 20 homes in Atascadero that had rooftop solar. And now last count I got was in excess of 450 residences in Atascadero that already have it up and running. That doesn't count the people who are in the pipeline to get that going. Is that really making any difference in what we're trying to do? Or is what I save in what I'm paying to PG&E on a given day improving that much over what I was doing 3 years ago?
Well, I would say it all makes a difference. And we are seeing an increase in rooftop and residential solar, and I think that's a great thing. And I think an important part of that, though, is to also ensure that our homes are efficient. And so we, as part of our planning process with communities, we encourage communities to look at their building stock and focus on older homes to be retrofitted for energy efficiency, and then to determine if renewable energy is feasible and appropriate, because some of our older homes they can't accommodate solar on the rooftop. So if that doesn't work for you, you aren't left with any options. You can address your use, you can reduce your use of energy, and you can ensure that it's efficient. So, you know, replacing your windows, doing insulation. These are all things we would do just to be comfortable in our homes and save us money, but they also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And each individual, these are additive, and cumulatively, they will make a difference.
Mm-hmm. The solar organization that put solar on my house told me they wouldn't put it on unless they did an energy assessment of the house. And three guys came out one day, and they were very amusing. I mean, they were very hardworking, and they knew what they were doing. But they were also three guys that were very amusing. It was kind of like having the Three Stooges in our house doing this. When they do this, the air pressure door thing to check things out and everything, it was a rather extensive process. And they found a number of things that had never occurred to us. Among other things, like the people who installed the last heater left an entire vent from the old heater open to the outside air, which meant every day when our heater ran, it also sucked in an extra 20% of the air that it was recirculating from an open line from the previous heater, which was fascinating. But anyway, let's see, we've got another caller here. I don't want to keep them waiting. I'm sorry. Okay, Joey, are you there? Hello?
Yes, okay. Yes, I am. Hi.
Okay. Hi there.
Yes, I came to your show a little bit late, so forgive me if I'm asking a question that you've already discussed. First of all, my husband and I have some land up in Wailo, Maui, and we go back and forth between the Central Coast and there, and we set it all up completely independent solar. Everything is solar on the house and electric car, and the electric car is charged through the solar. And they're a little bit more progressive, it seems, over there in Hawaii. They're moving really kind of rapidly in the direction of having electric car stations. And that's the only thing that I find kind of frustrating, in the mainland in general, in California. I'm not seeing enough electric car stations where you can charge your electric cars up. And we need to have as many of those as there are gas stations. And start phasing out the gas stations, I think.
Yeah. Well, Tammy, what is that being done at the regional level for municipalities and things? Are they looking at incentives to do that?
Absolutely. And it's an excellent point to make and very timely right now. The San Luis Obispo County Air Pollution Control District has a Clean Cities Coalition, and this is one of the topics that they are committed to exploring is ensuring that alternative fuel vehicles have the facilities they need, whether it's for electric cars or alternative fuels to keep moving. Because we do know that one of the barriers to electric cars has been what's called range anxiety, making sure that you can get where you need to be without being stranded on the freeway. And this is very important to the state. The California Energy Commission and other state agencies have just released, and I don't even know how many millions of dollars it is, in grants to ensure that there's a dedicated charging network from the Northern California to Southern California across all of our major freeways. And so that'll include supercharging, fast charging stations, as well as, I guess, what regular stations. And so we'll see, I think we'll see a significant increase in charging stations in the next couple years, definitely in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Can I just add one last question?
Go ahead.
Would anybody there like to discuss anything that's going on with Telsa and the battery, they're called the super battery that they're working on, that is supposed to kind of take care of everything in terms of our energy problem? If anybody would be interested in discussing that, I don't know.
So the Tesla battery?
Tesla battery, yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the super battery is what it's referred to.
Yeah, Michael, you want to jump into this?
Sure. I'm not an expert on battery technology, but yeah, this is part of Tesla's product line that they've announced will be a battery for your home that will allow you to basically store energy, and it'll particularly be valuable linked to a solar energy system such that during the day when you're producing a lot of solar power but you're not at home using much, you can be charging the battery so that when you come home in the evening. This is a big challenge. I'm certainly not the expert on renewable energy load management in California. There's great people very close by. Mm-hmm. I can tell you a lot about that. But this will be one of the challenges that we are facing it now. We've had days now in California where we've produced more renewable energy than we can use. So storage is like the next big thing. We've got to figure out ways to store power both in a decentralized fashion, which will the Tesla battery is aimed at the homeowner, mm-hmm. But also massive scale. And so there's quite a bit of effort at the state level to identify how we can do that. There's lots of clever ideas about it. But I was also going to mention, though, about just add to the charging. You know, the charging problem is probably going to be solved very quickly, and that's because it is being attacked from multiple angles. The private market as well is heavily moving in this direction, Tesla being one of them, announcing a dramatic increase in the number of stations they'll be providing throughout the country. Then you also have private companies now like ChargePoint coming in. They just struck a deal with Cal Poly, so now at Cal Poly we have a bunch more electric vehicle charging stations. There's a small fee attached to it, but it's a pretty good deal. And that was done through a public-private partnership, basically, with this company, ChargePoint. And there are others out there as well in addition to this one. So there's a lot of interest. And then the other thing I was going to mention is that increasingly you as well see cities and counties requiring charging stations as part of new development. So, for example, if you were to head out to Target here in San Luis Obispo, you're probably familiar that there's quite a few areas to charge your vehicle out front, and that came through a development condition from the city.
And those are second best parking spaces to the disabled parking spaces.
They're pretty darn convenient, yeah. Too, yes. My point, I think the big point here is this problem is getting attacked from a bunch of angles, and we're going to see a big change.
Yeah. And our updated building code will also require certain types of development, so from the state level. We'll have requirements that new homes and buildings be ready to accommodate electric vehicles and also solar rooftop PV installations.
Yeah. Joey, I'm gonna put you in an uncomfortable position a little bit. You're talking about in Hawaii you have an electric car. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Well, my curiosity is, do you have one in California? And not to pick on you, but I would ask, can you, if you don't have one in California, can you give us an idea of what the difference is in the two locations that affects your decision?
The only reason we have not invested in going in that direction is we're trying to make up our minds where we're going to finally end up, whether we're going to stay here or move there.
And so we didn't want to invest in the solar and set it up the way we did over in Mallory just yet. We'd love to, though. It just depends on whether we're going to move there. And the problem we're having is the sewer that they're building, we're kind of, you know, too close to comfort. so they're we're kind of out in the ranch land here on the valley, and we're going to just wait and see. And if it turns out to be good, then we'll stay here, and we're going to do the same thing that we did in Maui and set it up with solar and get an electric car. But if it's kind of where it's a problematic with the sewer, then we're thinking about moving permanently over to Maui.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason.
Yeah. Real clear answer. Thanks very much. Appreciate the call.
Sure thing. Thank you for all of the answers and discussion.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, one of the things that I've heard from some folks is that we've underestimated how much money you save by having an electric car. I know somebody locally, a colleague that has what amounts to, I believe, the least expensive fully electric car, the Nissan Leaf. And he contends that based upon having about a total of about a 60-mile-a-day commute, his savings in gasoline pays the lease payment on his Leaf. I think that for an awful lot of people, they're still in the category of believing that only electric cars out there that they might want to have cost $120,000. And I'm wondering if that's affecting that market. And is there any forecasting within urban planning and city planning going on right now that's giving anybody a sense of where that market is going to and whether or not it will indeed be a significant market?
There is forecasting. I'd have to flag it as research that needs to be improved, because I feel like the current research underestimates where we believe we're going to go with electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Michael, anything to add to that?
The economics of electric vehicles is still a little bit confusing, partly because we don't have a very good handle yet on sort of lifetime maintenance costs, which are expected to be significantly lower than an internal combustion engine. We'll know more about that soon. But I'd also add that the greenhouse gas emission benefits of electric cars is a bit of a complicated issue as well, because, for example, here in California, from a emissions reduction point of view, electric vehicles are kind of a no-brainer. But it's more complicated back east, because back east you're charging your car and you're primarily charging it from electricity that's generated by burning coal. And coal is much dirtier in terms of, well, all kinds of air pollution, but particularly in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So there's some studies that have, you know, said that electric vehicles, for example, you know, in Ohio aren't going to may not be any better than a traditional internal combustion engine. But as the nation's energy supply gets cleaner, and again, as Tammy had mentioned earlier, California's is a very clean energy supply relative to the rest of the country. As it gets cleaner, the benefit of these vehicles will accelerate. Every time we produce a little bit more solar power, for example, every electric vehicle on the road just got a little bit cleaner, just like that.
Yeah, I'm glad that's where you focused on the last part of that comment, because what occurred to me as you were saying that is if we can become more efficient in the Sun Belt, so if Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, California can find ways to produce more power than they need based upon growing efficiency in the system, is it feasible to push more of that into a national grid so we're augmenting what they're not doing with solar in parts of the Midwest and the East Coast? Is that feasible, or is it just too doggone hard to push power around the country that way?
Well, again, I'm not an expert at that, but I know it's generally very difficult to push power that way, basically. But we don't need to push power that way. We need those parts of the country to do their part. Germany has been incredibly effective at producing solar power. I wouldn't describe it as a sunny, deserty kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
We know that in places like New York and Ohio, we can produce a significant amount of solar power in those places. And then once you get out of California as well, quite a few states across the middle part of the country are excellent for wind. Texas, again, not a place known exactly for its overly concerned with climate change as a political issue, but Texas is one of our national leaders in wind energy. And Houston, Texas, the capital of the oil and gas industry, is one of the most progressive cities in the country on building green buildings, which are buildings that are much more energy efficient than a typical building. And so we even see in a place like Texas a lot of the right things going on. And again, a lot of times it's just because it's economically better. It's smarter economically. You don't have to care about the environment or climate change at all. These renewable sources of energy often pencil out quite well.
Yeah. But, you know, we have probably at least two-thirds of what we wanted to talk about not covered today anyway. So Tammy, I'll leave it with you. Okay, what did we not look at that we need to think about today? We've got a couple of more minutes left in the program. It's up to you to bring us back on focus for a little bit.
Well, it's important to not be too overwhelmed. It's a global issue. It's a complicated issue. There's uncertainty when it comes to climate change and forecasting. But it can be simple, and thinking about what we do as individuals and what we do as communities, it does matter and it does make a difference. And how we use energy, the decisions we make about how we use water and other resources, the fuels that we use, how we make our purchasing decisions, what we do with our waste, how we eat. These can all make a difference in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and you don't have to make fundamental changes to every part of your life, but you can make key choices about energy or transportation, just changing to an electric vehicle or choosing to walk to work one day a week or walking with your child to school one or two days a week. These are all important decisions that do more than reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
So we're heading in the right direction locally. We've got tons more to do, and I suspect there's a lot of this topic that we haven't sort of course covered in the time we had. Where do people go for? Is there a decent primer on what to do locally? Is there a particular book out or a particular website that we can send people to?
I would suggest the first thing people do is most of the cities and the counties, actually all the cities in San Luis Obispo, have done a climate action plan. So your city, if you're in San Luis Obispo County, your city has a climate action plan. I would suggest to get a hold of that, read it, and advocate in your community and to your elected officials to move forward with implementing that. That's a good way to become educated on the issue. We have our book on local climate action planning that we put out with Island Press a few years ago. And the American Meteorological Society, I can't remember the title, but they have a great book that's a primer on the science of climate change if folks want to learn
actually,
more about that.
Well, I'll have our producer get in touch with you, and we can basically put a note about that on the website. So people who are looking at the KCBX website for the archive of this program, we'll make sure that information's on there. We'll have Christina get a hold of you with that.
And one other resource would be 350.org for citizens who are interested in partnering with other community residents and like-minded individuals.
Okay. Great. We have to leave it with that today. I want to remind you this was Central Coast Voices. It's been a very, very lively discussion, and I appreciate our callers. I'm with you every other week. Chris Kington-Barker will be with you next week. She's going to be meeting with some folks from Arts Obispo, looking at the upcoming Americans for the Arts survey and the economic impact and educational impact on the arts in our schools and our community. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities, as I've told you before, along with KCBX, our partner here, of course. The program is also underwritten with a grant through from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we appreciate her support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or by phone at 543-2323. I want to thank my guests today, Michael Boswell and Tammy Seal. It's been a wonderful program. We've appreciated you being part of it today. This is Central Coast Voices. This is part of the community we want you to be a part of. By the way, pledge drive for spring will start back again on Monday. You can cut that short if you can by going online or by phone and making your pledge to KCBX to keep us all on the air. Thank you. This has been Central Coast Voices.